what China and Russia are doing is so different from what we've seen so far for decades from the West. It seems that China understands that at the end of the day, if these nations, Africans, Eastern Europe, in Middle East, if they grow in terms of their infrastructure, in terms of their economy, that would be a benefit for China and Russia. It seems that it's a long-term strategy, but they're doing this little by little.
Of course, it is a long-term strategy. It's how do you organize the system of international relations and international trade geoeconomically? It's a geoeconomic strategy. The Chinese, they came up with the Belt and Road Initiative in 11 years ago, actually. It was in 2013. The original idea was Russia. The original idea, years before, and Putin said it explicitly, oh, let's have an enormous free trade zone from Lisbon to Vladivostok. This was the embryo of what the Chinese later on developed as the New Silk Road, which, if we look only at Eurasia, would be a free trade zone between Shanghai and Xi'an all the way to Madrid. It's exactly the same thing. And of course, from a Chinese point of view, because they have the geoeconomic firepower and those enormous funds, Africa, Eurasia, and Latin America, Eurasia as well. So it's nearly global. The new Silk Roads encompass at least 80% of the planet. And the Russians, a few years later, after 2013, the New Silk Roads, they came up with the concept of a Greater Eurasia Partnership, which is an official concept in Russia. And one of the conceptualizers was Sergei Karaganov. I had the pleasure to talk to Karaganov at his office in late 2018 in Moscow. And these were the finishing touches of a Greater Eurasia Partnership, where it was about to be officially green, not green-lighted, but the Kremlin would start referring to it directly as official Russian policy. So it's essentially the same thing. Eurasia Partnership and the Silk Roads is a geoeconomic integration, trade, and commerce that is also geopolitical, because it changes the system that is always geared towards the lines of communication and the channels of communication and the maritime channels of communication controlled by the hegemonic power. For instance, if we have an international north-south transportation corridor, Russia, Iran, India, going to Russia all the way to Astrakhan, crossing the Caspian, and then down to the Persian Gulf, and then down to Mumbai. What do you skip? The Suez Canal, which is essentially controlled by the Americans, essentially. So this is a graphic example of how the whole pattern of international trade relations and commercial relations is being changed little by little. And that later on will lead us towards the possibility of the adoption of the Petro Yuan, midterm to long term. The fact that one of the key reasons to bring Saudi Arabia to the BRICS table is to have Russia, China, Iran, India discussing with Saudi Arabia, okay, let's try to establish a different pattern of commercial trade relations. And sooner or later, you're going to have to say bye-bye to the US dollar. And MBS, he's not a fool. He may be a very complicated character. He's not a fool. He understands the stakes. So this is how the whole thing, the whole chessboard is being changed in real time, all the time, especially driven by these two main actors. The beginning of our conversation, how you started our conversation. It's all about what Russia and China do together, deliberate together. Then they try to explain to their top partners everywhere. They're going to be discussing this tomorrow in Astana at the SCO meeting, the foreign relations meeting. They're going to be discussing it next month in Moscow at the BRICS ministerial meeting, which is going to be extremely important for the roadmap towards the summit in Kazan in October, and even for 2025 ahead. So when you see this strength and depth of planning, of long-term planning, little by little, step by step, it's extremely complicated in every dossier, but they had already started and they're doing it. And the partners are eager to be part of it, to contribute, to come up with new ideas, etc. The Africans, every time the Africans come to Moscow, they are in awe because they go, look, well, we are establishing something different together and you are helping us. With the Chinese, it's the same thing. And for over a decade, almost 2 decades, China investing in over 30, 35, at least 34 or 35 different African nations. Same thing. And will soon happen in some projects in Latin America, which are not part officially of Belt and Road, of New Silk Roads, but they are happening. By the end of this year, there will be the inauguration of a new port in Peru, which will be we can call it a certain Silk Road port, because it will involve exports from Brazil going to Peru and from other places in Latin America. And from this port, they go all the way to Shanghai. And guess what? The main administrator of the port is Chinese. So, you know, when you put this all together, it's fantastic. It's like you're watching a 3D, 4K game of Go in front of you. In a screen the size of the planet. And that's what makes it so exciting to all of us. And of course, we know with all the dangers in between.
In your opinion, with this new administration of Putin, we know that he put an economist as the head of the Ministry of Defense of Russia, and Shoigu was promoted to his new position. But when it comes to putting an economist as the head, how do you see what's the importance of this move on the part of Putin and why he's doing this, in your opinion?
It's brilliant. It's an absolutely brilliant strategic move because it shows that the Russian Ministry of Defense and the way Russia is a semi-militarized society because they are in the middle of a hot war against the whole West. You cannot get more hot war than that. You have a hot war on your western border against the whole collective West against you, throwing everything against you. And they will continue to throw more Wunderwaffen months after months and money and whatever months after months after months. You need a semi-militarized economy and you need it run by an economist. It's as simple as it gets. Shoigu is not an economist. Shoigu is not exactly a brilliant manager. Okay, many of you can disagree with me on that. It's okay, it's fine. But what we should all agree on is that when you have a top economist reorganizing the thrust of a semi-militarized economy that now has the most solid, the most competent military forces on the planet with zero competition from anybody. And when we get to the hypersonic domain, way ahead of anybody. So you need to streamline all that. You need a lot of cost benefits exercises. You identify sectors that you know need more investment or even more streamlining. And nothing better than a top economist to do that. It makes perfect sense. Total sense. The Chinese understood that clearly. And I'm sure the Iranians also did. They did not express it in public, at least not yet, but I'm sure they understand what that means, and including in terms of the military collaboration between Russia and Iran.
Yeah. In Switzerland, we were having a new discussion, a new summit about Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine. And Russia, they didn't invite Russia. here in Brazil, Lula said he's not going to be there, and because Russia is not there, and the head of South Africa said the same thing. We still don't know if China is gonna send a representative to this summit or not. But it's unbelievable the ignorance on the part of the West and why they're doing this to Russia. And because so far they didn't benefit from this animosity toward Russia, but it seems that they're doubling down. How they can get any sort of outcome from this summit without Russia?
There'll be no outcome, Nima. This is a PR operation. They may fool people who are already fooled inside what I call NATO's tent, the whole space, North America to Western Europe and Eastern Europe. They can fool simpletons. They can fool people who get their information from mainstream media. But these people are already lost. In terms of being a walking zombies, the people who really matter are people who make decisions. They are not fooled. The global South, the global majority, is not fooled. Everybody knows that starting today, May 20, that thing in Kiev is an illegitimate government, supported by nothing, legally, certainly illegally. They are in power because they decided that they will remain in power. Nothing, there's not a single piece of paper that supports that whole congregation of gangsters starting today, May 20. So what Medvedev already said in one of his posts, if I'm not mistaken, this morning is very, very funny. Okay, whoever is the bunch of gangsters who's over there, for us it's irrelevant. And it is. If there will be another bunch of gangsters next week or in 2 weeks, or if they throw Zelensky under the bus or not, from a Russian point of view, it doesn't matter. And it gets even worse for the West because something that didn't happen before, the system in Russia, the Security Council, President Putin, Lavrov as foreign minister, they tried everything. And now they finally lost their patience. They don't care. So the message now that, in fact, it's not a message. Now they are telling the West outright, look, we don't care that whatever you do, we don't care. If you want to discuss Ukraine, you have to be on our terms. The war in Ukraine ends when we say so. And the only thing that is left to discuss is the modality of rendition on the terrain, which will be not only the rendition of the bunch of gangsters in Kiev, but the whole of NATO. That's it. And this is the immovable high-speed rail train, let's put it this way, Russian. And there's nothing you can move this train. You cannot derail this train anymore. There will be serious attempts to provoke a really hardcore Russian response, or in their minds, the collective West, provoke some turmoil inside Russia. And I would say that the number one preoccupation for all of us is a possible attack on the Kerch Bridge this summer, which has already been announced, pre-announced. So there will be a serious attack against the Kerch Bridge between June and July. And what we heard from some of our very good sources that are extremely laconic in their wisdom, but sometimes in one or two words they say, oceans are contained in these words. The response, if Kiev and NATO and both try something against the Russian Federation, and especially against Kerch, is going to be the real thing, what many have been expecting for quite a while. And because this, it's beyond a red line for the bear. And the Russians have been saying it all the time. Look, think very carefully if you're attacking strategic targets, essentially civilian targets inside the Russian Federation. They are not listening. They're doubling down. So, okay, the response this time is going to be, I heard this weekend from a really, really good source. And so expect that this will be the devastating response that, in fact, many people who are already also fed up, not only in Russia, but all across Eurasia, were demanding. And the provocation will come, that's for sure. It could be a false flag, it could be a direct attack with loads of scalp and Storm Shadow missiles, maritime drones, you name it, using the new Wunderwaffen F-16s, you know, whatever the configuration, if there is such an attack, get ready. And then, of course, after that, all bets are off. None of us can tell what could happen next, which could be something unimaginable. So we are always on the brink of something really, really serious happening, at least until the end of this year. And of course, next year, depending on who's going to be sitting at the White House, it would change the narrative a little bit because China will become the number one existential threat. But of course, Ukraine won't disappear from one day to another. So what's so hard for the leadership in Moscow is to calibrate carefully how to advance in the battlefield, where to go, where to say, okay, that's it, when to decide, okay, we stop, and keep waiting, of course, for some sort of okay, I would say fragment of dialogue from the other parts, which will not come. So you have to manage all these things at the same time, nonstop. It's extremely complex, as complex as managing our transition towards a multipolar, a geoeconomic and geopolitical world.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned, the situation is so dangerous and so serious because the first time Russia is talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and Navy getting involved, these are really serious signs coming out of Russia because they didn't talk about it before. It shows how serious the situation is right now. And at the same time, we've heard that a member of Bundestag in Germany was talking about Poland and Romania using the NATO air defense system and shooting everything in the western part of Ukraine. And we know that the last days of war against Nazi Germany were the bloodiest days. And do you think that we're going to witness the same thing in this conflict in Ukraine?
Could be, and that's the problem, Nima. This is the worst case scenario, which it's always I would say among the top three possible scenarios, even this year, and from this year to 2025, because from a psychological point of view, and from the psychology of psychopaths, which is what we're all dealing with, in terms of the leading political elites across NATO stand, it's absolutely impossible for them to admit that they failed on every project, that they failed on everything that has been planned, they have been planning for over 10 years, and they also failed on the battleground. They failed geoeconomically. Now they are seen as pariahs by the whole planet, literally. Like the global majority sees NATO stand as a whole as pariah states. Canada is a pariah state. France and Britain are pariah states. And even the hegemon is a pariah state in the eyes of 87, 88, 89% of the world's population. This is a fact. And they will never recover from that. And compounded to the fact that they are enabling, authorizing, weaponizing, and justifying a genocide in Gaza. With all that, that's it. You know, the lines could not be clearer, in fact. So what do they have left? Provoke a hot war, an enormous hot war, and which, of course, they will be the first ones to disappear if they do that. Of course, in their minds, no, we are protected, whatever. The same crap that they try to convince themselves of, this crap all the time. So the key on a human basis, the impossibility of rational people sitting down at the same table and discuss, which is the basics of diplomacy as we know it. It doesn't exist anymore. They only know how to issue threats, sanctions, and organize scenarios where in their minds they can corral their enemies or destabilize their enemies from the outside, or much better, from the inside. One of the key readings that these people are making of what happened with Raisi's helicopter is how to use the whole thing to destabilize Iran. It's the only thing that matters for them. There's nothing else. So we could draw a list of these past few weeks of a series of coincidences, and the targets, voluntarily, involuntarily, coincidentally, not so coincidentally, in a very dodgy manner, etc., they happen to be all of them actors who understand perfectly what Russia, China is doing, or are defending Russia and China, or are on the same camp as Russia and China, and or are being protected directly, indirectly, or on the background by China. So this won't disappear. On the contrary, this is part of the current hybrid war, which is now a hot hybrid war. The only thing left for these elites is, okay, let's try to destabilize everyone, everybody, anywhere. That's it. A series of attempts at color revolutions, attempts on political leaders, to provoke mini hybrid wars and mini color revolutions anywhere they can, to keep important people there against them in jail, the case of Imran Khan in Pakistan, for instance. So this is where we are, you know. And of course, Russia, China, they know this absolutely. Coming back to the meeting that Putin had with his defense team and the Iranian ambassador in Moscow, they know exactly what's going on. So, you know, at least they know. What they cannot predict, of course, is where the next coincidence will happen and who is going to be the next one to be targeted.
It seems at least we know that in Georgia there are some coincidences going on. And
when there is a coincidence going on in Georgia, exactly.
We know that in Georgia there is a law passed in the parliament, law on foreign agents. And the parliament passed this law, and then the president of Georgia vetoed this law. We, at the same time, we were seeing protests on the streets. And it's so amazing to see the foreign ministers of Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia participating in these protests in Georgia. How dangerous is this? And why they're doing this in a foreign country? Foreign ministers, it's so amazing why they're doing this, in your opinion. This is just before our eyes, they're doing color revolution. I don't know how we can call it.
Or let's call it the Baltic Chihuahua color revolution, Nima. Because the Baltic Chihuahuas, they have nothing better to do with their lives. These are three mega insignificant pieces of land, not very far from St. Petersburg, for that matter. So, you know, so they hop on a plane, they go to Georgia, and they support a color revolution, which is clearly instigated, organized, financed, et cetera, by the Americans. That's the only thing they know what to do. Okay, why don't you cross the border? Why don't you go to Russia? Why don't you try to call a revolution inside Russia? You'll be turned into chicken Kiev in 5 minutes, all of you Baltic Chihuahuas. So it's a joke. This should not even be considered as serious players, because they aren't. But, of course, they figure in the organization of NATO as the Americans see it for the future. And this, I would say, is even bipartisan in Washington. They want a NATO that is basically controlled, that they control, of course, they continue to control, But the main actors are going to be London, Warsaw, and the Baltic Chihuahuas, because Project Ukraine collapsed. So no more Ukraine in the picture. So what's left for them is London, Warsaw, and the three Chihuahuas. So, of course, they use the Chihuahuas to instigate cultural revolutions in the post-Soviet space, which is what's happening now with Georgia. And considering that Project Ukraine failed, we are back to Project Georgia, which of course never left the picture. It was just in the background. So now it's back again. It's so we have to be tired because we're always dealing with the same bunch of idiots doing the same bunch of stupidity things over and over again. The problem is, of course, this concerns vast regions, whole populations, serious regions in several nodes of the planet, and the consequences of all that, they are terrible. And we cannot escape it. We cannot even prevent it, which is what Russians, especially, even more than the Chinese, would like to do, but it's impossible. You would need that 20 Russian administrations with 20 defense teams to try to prevent all that. And with the millions of informants spread all over, especially the post-Soviet space, you can't.